We're joined today by Tony Cotty, who's the business relationship manager here at Sussex County Cricket Club. Cots is a bit of a legend. We really like him. He's a lovely guy. Sometimes funny when he gives his boundary club jokes and speeches, sometimes inappropriate. There's our Cots. No, we're delighted to know Cots and to be part of Sussex County Cricket Club here at the Exec Suite. Cots has been a real assistance here with us, obviously developing our contacts with Sussex and also getting to know the team here, the club, and what they do and how they obviously support the community through the foundation, which isn't part of what Cots does, but also businesses. So yeah, I just wanted to introduce Cots. And by the way, this isn't the Tony Cotty of Everton fame, this is Tony Cotty cricket fame, just to be clear.
The poorer one,
yeah. But he's got a bit of money, actually.
More than me.
Yeah. So I'm going to do some career stats for Cots. I don't know if this is correct, because I actually asked Sarah to run this off Wikipedia. Apparently you've got a Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
You've made it. First class cricket, Cots played 277 games. Is this right?
Yeah, thereabouts.
Yeah? How many runs did you score, do you know?
First class, just under 15,000.
14,567. What was your batting average?
36.5.
36.69. Looks like you've been doing your own Wikipedia page. Right, how many hundreds?
31.
Oh, you knew that. 50s?
70.
73. Top score?
203.
Who's that against?
Leicester.
Oh, brilliant. Where was that? Here?
It's now my home ground, St Helens, Swansea.
Oh, superb. Oh, that's a good... Oh, you've actually spoke about that before. Bowls, ball, bowled.
Oh, no idea. I was rubbish bowler.
1,534. Actually, you were pretty rubbish.
Declaration
how many wickets? How many wickets did you get in that time?
Dozen.
16. That's horrendous. That's actually horrendous.
That's part-time bowler, wasn't
it? Yeah, I know. Well, bowling average?
40.
59.62. Oh, amazing.
That's wrong. That's got to be wrong.
Amazing. Right, okay. So, I've just got a few questions for you, Cots. I'm really grateful for you to come here and obviously speak to us on the podcast. So, tell us a bit about how you became the business relationship manager here, in charge of sponsorship, and your journey, really, from playing to in the business community.
Okay. Well, basically, I had 13 years at Glamorgan, and then I had my last 6 seasons at travel up to Sussex, and I rented up here. But when I finished my career, I was 38, and leading up to that is a really kind of uncertain time for a lot of sports people, whether it's financial or just what you're going to do with the rest of your life. And coupled with the fact I'd lost a lot of contacts in Wales during my 6 years in Hove, always knowing I was going to go back to Wales to settle. So I was very fortunate, really. I got a job, I got a job interview via a mate, wife, who was a training advisor. And I went into a college, really, and I dealt with, I suppose, people who are high achievers in sport, who are very competitive. And then I went into a college where I was trying to get people, it's called New Deal, trying to get people out of work, placed in work and back to college. People who are maybe third generation unemployed or alcoholics, drugs and stuff like that. So it was a real culture shock, but actually I was really lucky to get into that kind of job straight away. Finished on the Friday, started on the Monday back home, and then supplemented that with things you'd expect after dinner, speaking, pro and in the leagues, coach Wales under 15s, that kind of thing. So it was just trying to find what I was going to do next. Then I left after 2 years. An ex-player invited me to set up a cricket showroom. He had a company called Absolute Snooker, which was partly snooker, and then he wanted to set up cricket as well, Absolute Cricket. And then out of the blue, I got a phone call from Sussex saying that Neil Lenham had finished. He was business relationship manager here. I knew a lot of the sponsors. Would you like to come up? And that was the first time I came up and I settled. So that was 2009. And basically, you know, bought a flat here and settled. So it was a bit of a culture shock, you know, you're up in sticks, and I never really thought I would leave Wales to come up here. And when I got here, there's probably about 30 sponsors. So for the first 2 years, it was all about getting out in the community. I do a lot of after-dinner speaking, so I'd go to every kind of opening of an envelope, really, and they say, would you say a few words? So I'd do that. And just building a network of people and trying to maintain what we got, but try and build a sponsorship network here, which as we're sitting here now, we've probably got about 160, 170 sponsors at the club, and building that kind of business community that people like yourselves tap into, because you know that if you come to a boundary club here, one of our networking lunches, that you know you're going to rub shoulders with 150 like-minded businesses within the area.
Yeah, absolutely. We really enjoyed a Boundary Club, actually. I think it's probably the best monthly or organised lunch group in the area, I have to say. I find that some are obviously a bit hit and miss, but it's always on point. And the Boundary Club's got bigger, actually. I think I joined about 6-7 years ago. I first came, but it's just got so much bigger, and it's the quality of the people there is great as well.
Yeah, we're lucky. Obviously, cricket lends itself to that kind of environment. I mean, a lot of networking clubs are morning breakfast and that, and ours is a lunchtime, and there's cricket going in the background, but it's 4-day cricket. I don't think T20 really lends itself to it, because it's a little bit like football. It's two or three hours, and it's 100 miles an hour. It's a long, slowish day. The championship cricket, and it gives people an out. Sometimes it's difficult to get into conversations. You know, I see people, you know, ladies who don't know much about cricket. Well, do you know much about cricket? You come off. Yeah. It's a kind of a background thing, and it's a long afternoon, and there's a few drinks as well. That always helps loosen people's inhibitions. And a lot of people use it in the area because they know there's 10 of their clients going to be here. So it's a great way once a month to touch base with them. And then other people use it predominantly to make new contacts in the area.
So your role here as business relationship manager, what would you say, apart from dealing with us, is your biggest day-to-day challenge?
Day-to-day challenge? It's like kind of two jobs, mine. I mean, in the winter, I call it my proper job. That's where I've got quite a heavy budget. It's 900 grand, I think, out of my budget, and in sponsorship, and that's mine. So I look to retain corporate partners and sponsors of the club. And through the summer before that, you're picking up new contacts. So major sponsors is always a challenge, because it's tough to get, you know, a shirt sponsor and ground sponsor when you compete, for instance, against a football club down the road. Cricket isn't football, so it's a constant challenge, you know, to make sure that you engage with those major sponsors and that they're happy with what they're getting, the return they're getting at the club. And that's something that our team is constantly looking to improve and make sure that on times of renewal that they're happy enough to continue with the club.
Yeah, no, I get that, which is, I think, why when we were deciding to renew our sponsorship, we did it a year early. A, because I thought, you know, it saves you a lot of hassle. I can imagine your job is day-to-day. It's a lot of work, and, it's not a grind. You enjoy working with the people, but it can obviously...
One thing I would say is that, you know, when you played sport I was 16 to 38, when you play sport that length of time, to be out of it for 5 years, it focuses the mind, and then to get an opportunity back in within a sports club is fantastic. And you know, we're very lucky, a lot of us, to work within Sussex. It's a great club. It's one of those clubs that, you know, you never know from one day to the next exactly what's going to happen, because it can get very busy. All hands on deck, but ultimately it's great to be involved in a sports club. And I did a bit of coaching when I first came here, and you know, with the first and the second team, gone away on trips and that. But ultimately, you find out where your focus lies, and where I am now is where I'd like to be, and I'm enjoying it.
So in terms of the business people you come across, and obviously being an elite sports person yourself back in. For 19 years,
black and white telly.
Yeah, black and white telly. we had a meeting and a presentation from Gail Ems at the Oval, badminton player.
Yeah.
And she said that the biggest similarity between athletes and the differentiation actually between them is simply put down to their hunger to win. She said that obviously at that level, the physicality and ability is always going to be quite similar. There's only a variation of a small degree between them. But it's the hunger to win that's the difference. I mean, would you say that in the business people that you've met, there's similarities between sports people and business people and what they do?
No, definitely. I mean, there's a massive crossover. Just within the job I'm doing, I was kind of judged as a player on an hourly, daily basis by coach, myself, papers, newspapers and media and whatever, and supporters. So you're in that world where performance is everything. And the sales... job I'm in now is a little bit slower in the fact that you can plan it a bit more. You know I've got to hit the budget, but at the end of the day I've got X amount of months to hit that, so you can see trends. But ultimately you still got to be performance based, and I think that's what, when you look at businesses that are here, a lot of people here are all about returns and how they can achieve, you know, KPIs, things like that. It's you're driven and you're always looking to challenge yourself, and I see that in a lot of the sponsors. As you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of decision makers at the club within the Boundary Club, the Players Club as well. Yeah, you know, people who own their own businesses, and they are driven, and I see very similar traits, you know, to people I played in the dressing room with.
So in terms of, I mean, we could talk about business for a while. Actually, like, just to digress a little bit, I actually played football with you once in a five-a-side. You were actually decent, very good. You were like a little Lionel Messi.
Well, that's 3 years as a pro, so that...
Did you? I was going to...
It was a long time ago, but 16 to 19, I was at the Swans.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you think you could have had a career in football?
I only played a handful of football league games. I don't know, I was always kind of cricket or football. I always felt I was a better footballer, but it was a little bit more cutthroat at that time. You had a little bit more time to develop in cricket, and signed by John Toshack, sacked by John Bond. Two big names really in football, probably not for people you know, of your, you would remember, you know.
Yeah,
you're not that young anyway.
just for a podcast viewers, he looked at Hamish when he said that.
No, I didn't know.
In both of them, he could have been a footballer, couldn't he?
He played a bit for Scunthorpe. I mean, I had a chance to go to Birmingham for a year after I got, released is better than sacked, isn't it? Released from the Swans. And I didn't, because my old coach at Glamorgan had already played an under-15s. When I was 15, played a second 11 game for Glamorgan and done okay. So he said, look, the uni guys are away. Do you want to have a game at the start of the season? And I played and I did pretty well. And then I didn't really look back. I ended up playing a bit for Merthyr, semi-pro, because you couldn't do the both. And then didn't really go to Birmingham for that. And, you know, ended up playing, 18 years, 19 years of cricket. So you never know, really. I obviously wasn't good enough at the time, so you move on to something else. But I found cricket a bit harder than football, to be honest.
What would you say, going back to the cricket now at Sussex, what's the difference now, do you think, between the players and the players in your day? What would you say?
Well, I can tell you my first... When I was 15, I was 12th man for Glamorgan, because I couldn't get in the second team at that particular time. And I went on a away trip to Cambridge University. It was a Benson Hedges game. And I would say the fitness levels were the same as a darts team, especially when I've been involved in football. So my warm down as well, even when I was at Sussex, I was one of the senior players there, but at Sussex, we trained really hard at Sussex under Peter Moores, but we were allowed the odd drink, and two or three Budweisers was my warm down and an ice bath. Whereas now you've got we had bleep tests, but it's very fitness oriented. Yep. It's all about, you know, skin folds and the, you know, as fit as you can be. Fielding has just gone on remarkably. I mean, yeah. Bowling's different, batting and everything, but for me, the fitness levels in as a cricketer now compared to that darts team
a catch, athletic catch, could be the difference between a win and a loss, so yeah, it's very important.
You never see that, catching it behind the rope, throwing it up and catching it, you know, running back in the field. And if you see before games, they practice those kind of things now, so it's all evolved. Batting is very innovative, bowling has to be, because a white ball doesn't move a lot. So there's still a big difference between white ball and red ball cricket. If you watch the championship here, people still can struggle to play a moving ball. But in white ball cricket, watching Owen Morgan play the other night was unbelievable, really. 17 sixes, I think. And, you know, against Rashid Khan as well, who's he is the top T20 bowler in the world. Mm. You know, and it was unbelievable to watch. And the skill levels they've got now are second to none, really.
Six sixes in one over.
Yeah, more sixes that day than I had in my career. Then.
I can check that, actually. No, I've got the statistics here, mate. No, you're just about ahead there. what was your highlight of your career, Cots? And conversely, what was your low point?
Highlight of my career was I was 27. Go back to when I was a kid. I watched Viv Richards score 291 against England at the Oval, 1976, parched, beautiful summer that year. And from that moment on, I wanted to be a cricketer. Viv came and played at Glamorgan 1990, 92 and 3, and I batted middle order with him. And we hadn't won anything at Glamorgan for 24 years, and we went to Canterbury. If we won that game against Kent, Sunday League, we win it. Win the league, and if they win, they win it. First and second, massive crowd, 12,000-15,000. You know, at Canterbury, it was a huge crowd there, Welsh people up there. BBC followed us all through the year, BBC Wales followed us, the team around. And ended up going into Bath. We wanted 60-odd to win with Viv, and we both not out at the end. First thing we'd won for 24 years, you're batting with your hero, kind of thing. So
brilliant.
Never really got much better. I won a couple of championships as well, but for a moment, running off there was just a special moment.
Oh, superb. Yeah, I still dream about playing up front for Liverpool, Robbie Fowler. And it's never going to happen now. You know, I can imagine that's what it
would do, is running for it.
Yeah. Or we can do mine. I don't know. I wasn't exactly mobile. Or, you know, and conversely, you know, that was a very high point. What would you say would be your low point?
Low point, difficult really. I mean, yeah, it's a very mental game. You mentioned Gail Emms and that. Batting, everyone gets to a certain level, and whatever that may be, and then it depends on your mental state, I think. I mean, to be on the back of four or five low scores when the team is winning, you're struggling, it's a team game made of individual performances, you potentially could get dropped, and try and keep that equilibrium between still being the same person, if you're a chirpy person, still being chirpy in the dressing room and giving energy when you're struggling and the team's winning. And vice versa, when you're doing well and the team's losing, not being too far ahead of yourself. That's the hardest part of sport, and I've been in lots of seasons where you don't know where your next run's coming from, and that's a low point. I've had many times in hotels away where I woke up hoping it was going to rain because I wouldn't have to bat and I could hang in the, do you know what I mean, those kind of feelings. And a lot of my teammates, once, not at the time, but once they finished and they've done a book, there's a lot of similar traits from batters in that. So that's a generalisation. You can see why mental health plays a big part in cricket, because A, you're continually in that I suppose mentally challenging environment. And then I mentioned earlier about the fact that when you come to an end of a career, what am I going to do next? I still got 30 years to work. And cricket doesn't pay, it certainly didn't in my time, pay what football pays. So the finance is a big issue as well. And by that time you've got a young family and you're basically looking to start again. So those are the two parts of cricket. You can see why the mental issues have come out over the last 10 years. On an individual basis, I suppose that I lost four semi-finals. I never got the Lords in a final. And the last day here, when it was a funny one, the last year, because they asked me to play another year at Sussex, and I thought I hadn't planned on doing it, and I was playing pretty well at the time, but tailed off at the end of the season, and by the end of the season they'd signed somebody else, and I'd kind of given up on the game, and then got hope raised, and then at the end said, look, now I think you're 38 now, you're pretty much done. So that was a sobering moment, to be honest. I spent it behind the side screen. I wouldn't be, I'd have to say, I did shed a tear, and then realised I didn't have my keys, I had to go back into the room, I just got sacked. I said, can I have my keys back, please? But yeah, so that was quite tough. But I mean, you know, nothing compared to the 22 years. You know, it doesn't outweigh any of the 22 years of playing a game you love with your mates.
Yeah, no, I can say, I mean, it's business is quite similar in terms of that. You know, like, you have good days, you have bad days, you have days that you're mentally challenged and days where you just want to give up and go and leave. And I mean, I certainly get that as well. I mean, I'm sure Hamish does as well. But I was reading something about Jurgen Klopp the other day. And obviously, being a Liverpool fan, I read up about it. It's his emotional intelligence. That is like, and I was just fascinated what this guy was writing, that Klopp is such a level person in terms of the how he portrays himself in interviews and what he says about his team, that if you look at all the players, they have such a very good emotional intelligence. And like, in terms of management, I mean, certainly everyone can improve, me certainly, to improve those aspects of what you're doing. But it really resonated with me that actually for other people around you to have that kind of stability and mental health and kind of, you know, levelness, which you need in business or anything, it comes from the top, that kind of emotional intelligence as well. Klopp isn't erratic. Like Mourinho last year for Manchester United was completely OTT. I mean, he was having a go at one player. He was openly, publicly criticising the board, criticising players. There was no stability. But in contrast, Pep Guardiola and Klopp were just so emotionally balanced. Would you say that obviously, when you were playing, that obviously you said that the difference in the fitness levels and the drink and alcohol obviously causes lots of issues as well. If you drink even one or two pints a night, would mess up your sleep patterns and everything. Would you say that, like, now the players have got a lot more support in terms of that emotional intelligence and the health side of things and mental health than you did?
Yeah, to be honest, a couple of beers, slept like a baby.
Did you?
But, yeah, look, the PCA is fantastic. I mean, you know, they, when I started, I think one player had played for 25 years and ended up with 12 grand in his pension. I mean, the PCA are fantastic now. You know, they've got a benevolent fund, so any cricketer who's ever played the game and been a member of the PCA gets looked after. All the youngsters now, there's no excuse really not to be on some kind of educational course, because they'll fund or help fund things like that. So it has changed massively on that. And the benevolent fund and the mental well-being is highlighted massively, especially over the last couple of years. So, I mean, yeah, absolutely, it's changed. You know, for me, you mentioned about the ups and downs and handling them. I think that's the one thing. You get transferable skills, so they say, from sport. The one thing that cricket as a batter, a journeyman batter, I'll be honest there, over 19 years has taught me is it dealing with ups and downs and not getting too, as I mentioned, not getting too low when you're doing badly and the team's doing well, and not getting too full of yourself when it's the other way around. And I think 19 years of that, you will come out of it with some kind of social intelligence. Mm. And I mean, you know, that's the part I'd like to think I brought into the job I'm doing now, is that you don't jump in, you kind of take a back seat and look at the bigger picture and question where's the win in that? Where's the win in you know, responding like that, you know, and try and avoid confrontations until they're very necessary. And I actually had a really good course recently. A lady came in and did savvy conversations with us, and it was really interesting on my level of where you back off because you can see that there's no win in it, and when you've got to have that, well, I wouldn't say it's truthful, but you're that honest. Mm. You're there really to, in my world, to actually get a deal over the line.
Mm.
But there's a lot of stuff that goes on before that and whatever to build relationships and everything and build trust. And a lot of that's in the changing rooms. And sometimes we've had players that have been fantastic, but team people, you wouldn't have them anywhere near you. And yet their performance levels are very high. Now, if you're a Klopp or in my day, Peter Moores, you've got to decide whether their performance is so good that you're going to try and find a way to keep them in your team, even at the adverse effect of team spirit, or you're going to say, no, team spirit is more important and creating that culture. And I think the best managers are not the ones who continually tell people what to do. They build a culture that in the end, the team drives that culture, not the manager. He's done his bit, and then he sowed the seeds, and then you get some really good senior pros that jump all over that and realise this is a great environment to work in. And I think that once you've got that, it grows from within. And if the manager goes, it doesn't really matter because the culture's already there in place. And I think how many times have you seen a football team get a new manager, win 4 games straight away because everyone lifts their game, and then they go back to the way they were.
100%. So the Manchester United last season.
So it's the culture, really. And Peter Moore's, you know, it's no coincidence that Mark Robinson worked under Peter Moores, and that golden era of Sussex cricket was driven. I signed 99. He told me we'd win the championship in 5 years' time. We did win it. 2003, we won the championship. I know that's a bit coincidental, but that was the drive to get a team culture together that bought into that. Mm. And if people didn't, they got cast aside to a certain degree. And then Mark Robinson built on that. And that's what the culture that you know that you saw over the last 15 years at Sussex was built on.
I agree. So also, it's interesting with England at the moment. I mean, the team looks very solid, doesn't it? And it looks again emotionally intelligent. Against Afghanistan the other day, it was job done. You know, the old England teams would be a little bit banana skin, potential banana skin. Oh dear, you know, and there'll be that kind of apprehension straight away, but England were just job done. And I wonder whether the team effort, I mean, they effectively sacked Kevin Peterson because he was, as you say, he was a very, very good individual player, but terrible for the change room. From what people say, I mean, I don't know, I mean, this is just what I've read, but, you know, he might be great in the change room, but from what I've read, he was a real divisive character in the change rooms. And I guess they made a decision that it's better not to have an individual talent like that, but to build a team. Mm. And you're seeing that now in England. That's a good point, actually. Cots, finally, just to wrap this up, and thanks for today. I guess your job is made so much easier when you've got people like Joffre Archer bowling at the club.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Joffre is fantastic. Chris Jordan needs to take a massive pat on the back for the way Joffre is, not just as a cricketer, but as a person as well. Two great lads who've tasted a lot of success. Tamal Mills as well, you know, people who have come to the club probably from somewhere else and looking to, reinvent themselves a little bit, whether it's through injury or whatever, and they've done fantastically well. And cricket is a game now where, from nowhere, with this IPL and Big Bash, that you can be a journeyman cricketer at 26, 27 maybe, and you have two or three great years in white ball cricket, and all of a sudden there's £1 million paycheck or whatever. So, you know, it helps from a sponsorship perspective because we got the finals day last year. Our TV figures were fantastic for 2020 because of that, and any success puts bums on seats in the ground, hospitality gets filled, so success does play a big part. But I think we've got to be pretty mindful that the boys are under quite a lot of pressure anyway. They're always trying to deliver the best they can, and but we do understand that the home quarter final, no pressure this year. The home quarter final will be fantastic in T20 because it's an extra game where it keeps the season bubbling along. So it's a nice feel between the office side of things, ground staff, and the playing side, and certainly Dizzy's played a big part in that. You know, a lot of simple things that he'll do, that we got an internal, you know, email that goes round, and when it's someone's birthday, for instance, there's always cakes. You know, they bring cakes and put them in the kitchen, and wherever he is, he'll always tweet happy birthday so-and-so or whatever. So little things like that kind of build, that can go back to culture again, that it's not playing side over there, office staff over here, ground staff over here. It's trying to create that culture that we're all in it for the same goal, really, to have a successful side out there on the field and successful off the field.
Yeah. Cots, thank you very much. We really enjoy being part of the club, and thank you immensely. You're a really top guy, and you've really welcomed us and become a friend, really, more than anything else. So thanks very much.
And thank you for your support.
No worries. Thanks, mate. Cheers. Hello, you lovely people. Just to note that this is a podcast and does not constitute legal advice. Should you require any specific legal advice based on anything, then please contact your solicitor, or even better, us, and we can advise you fully.